From Autosport.com and Autosport Magazine, I'm Kevin Turner, and this is the Autosport Podcast. Welcome to the latest episode of our journey through the history of the Formula One World Championship, picking out the best season of the 75 years of the World Championship for drivers. Each time we pick a special guest that comes along and argues the case for their favourite F1 season. And in this episode, I can welcome Jake Boxall-Legg. Jake, welcome. Oh, you're looking forward to this one. I can feel it.
Yeah, exactly. I think you are scraping the barrel with your guests at this point to get me on, but hopefully I think
that's rather harsh. You cover F1, you're a tech guru, you understand the history of the sport.
You might be regretting that when we get into this, because we've had a few arguments about this in the office before, actually. Well, just heated debates, let's put it that way.
Yeah, I think there are far worse seasons that you could... Well, let's get into it. Let's start, as we have done with all the other episodes. Which year have you chosen, and briefly why, and then we'll get into the details.
So today, Kev, we are going to party like it's 1999, because I've chosen 1999. And that is purely because, just to kind of set the scene a little bit here, when I was very young, I was a very hyperactive child, which is something that might surprise people today. And my dad plonked me in front...
We need to explore that, but probably off air.
my dad plonked me in front of the TV and Formula One happened to be on, and that was it. That was the thing that kept me occupied for 2 hours. And 1999 was the first season in full that I ever watched. And I think it was just this, first of all, as a kid, I think it was this field of just super colourful cars. Like, it was a very colourful grid in 99. I think that's true. The thing that drew me to it. But then the season just seemed to have so many twists and turns that it was impossible not to be transfixed by it. And as somebody that probably wasn't au fait with the kind of history of Formula One at that point, I just took it for what it was, and I really, really enjoyed it. And that was the thing that got me hooked on F1 eventually. So it's the season that led me to this point to be sat here right now, I think.
So it's the reason we've got to put up with you.
Yes, okay. Exactly.
Strike against so that, 99.
That moves it down further in your rankings.
Well, it's certainly true to say there's... Well, let's give a sort of brief summary, as we've done before. So in terms of... We had six winners from four different teams. Megan Häkkinen won five races for McLaren, and in the end won the championship by just 2 points at the Suzuka finale from Ferrari driver Eddie Irvine. We're definitely going to be coming back to that. Heinz Harald Frentzen won two races for Jordan and was actually in the championship fight probably up until... Probably the Nürburgring, which is a race we're definitely going to be talking about. David Coulthard won a couple of races from McLaren as well. Marcus Schumacher also won two, but didn't do, of course, the full season. We'll come to that in a minute. And there was that brilliant day at the Nürburgring that Johnny Herbert won for Stewart from 14th on the grid, I think it was. So good number of winners. I think in terms of pace, the story can be told by the fact that Häkkinen had 11 pole positions, Marcus Schumacher 3, Rubens Barrichello 1, and Frentzen 1. And on the super times, the raw pace, the McLaren had an advantage of more than 0.5%. Now, in normal, certainly in the modern era, I'm not sure when the modern era begins, let's say the 21st century, a team with that level of advantage would absolutely smash the field, win the championship easily. It's a bigger gap than Red Bull had in 2023, for example, when it won all but one of the races. So I guess the start point is, how the hell did we end up with a championship fight across the 16 races, as it was then, despite McLaren's pace?
I think it was a mix of many things. I think the one that's kind of cited the most is that Häkkinen made a real meal of it. And I think you can look at it on the merits that obviously Michael Schumacher broke his leg in that crash at Silverstone. And I think Häkkinen maybe didn't feel pushed by the presence of Schumacher like he had in 1998. His biggest challenger at that point was Eddie Irvine. And even at that point, Irvine had been relatively consistent. And he probably was having his best season at Ferrari, but he'd only run one race up until that point. He didn't really get into the championship fight until after that, until Schumacher had broken his leg and was on the bench for six races. That's when Irvine started to come alive. And I think Häkkinen dropped the ball, I think it would be fair to say. But there are so many other things where McLaren really, really made a pig's ear of it. Again, there was Mercedes unreliability. Australia should have been pretty much a copy paste of what it was in 1998, and it wasn't. The two McLarens waltzed into the lead, and just looked like they would dominate as they had done a year prior. Unfortunately, Coulthard had what I believe was a hydraulics or an electronic issue in that race. Hakkinen came to a crawl as the race was gearing up for the restart under the after the first safety car. And the wheels just sort of started to fall off, quite literally in the case of Silverstone.
I was just going to say, actually, I mean, it wasn't just, I mean, look at quickly just picking them out. I mean, Hakkinen crashed out of the lead at Imola. Obviously, he had that famous spinning out of the lead at Monza and then hiding behind bushes, but getting seen by a helicopter anyway. Lost the wheel at Silverstone. He got punted at Austria by DC and had to charge through to third. So lots of points left on the table.
And in Germany, his tyre exploded. That's right. Knocked off the rear wing at the same time and ended up having quite a big crash. So again, there was unreliability. There was Hakkinen making a bit of a mess for the Italian races. It was kind of almost surprising that he did win it. I think on balance, he was the right driver to win it. And I think you would definitely agree with that. But there were just, it was a catalogue of errors. It really was.
Yeah, I think that's, I'd agree with both of those points. I do remember thinking at the end of the season, he really will close this out, won't he? But actually, I think we could probably introduce it at this point. The standout drivers of the season in many respects were Frentzen in the Jordan. The 199 was probably the most competitive Formula One car they ever produced. Got themselves sort of into the championship fight because of those problems. Because Ferrari were a little bit inconsistent with their pace as well. And they also had their own occasional moment, like not having enough wheels to put on Irvine's car, the Nürburgring. And Ralf Schumacher, who was outstanding in the fairly mediocre Williams and absolutely destroyed IndyCar star Alex Zanardi, the other car, which I remember being quite disappointed about because I was a big Zanardi fan. I'm sure many people were. So they were the kind of standouts, but the car wasn't quite there. Irvine had a consistent season, but didn't have the pace. Hakkinen had the pace, but not always the reliability and a couple of errors crept in. So I guess, is it the randomness and the unpredictable nature of it that is one of the reasons why it's your favourite season?
I think so. And I think the best example of that is Australia, because we have a podium of Eddie Irvine winning his first Formula One race. We have Heinz-Harald Frentzen finishing second and Ralf Schumacher finishing third. Irvine had driven a strong, solid race in Australia. It wasn't stellar by any stretch, but it was a good, solid race. And when the McLarens fell off the road, when Schumacher failed to get going off the start, let's also introduce the chaoticness of that start, where both Stewarts spontaneously combusted.
Oh, yes.
Schumacher didn't get off the line. Hakkinen didn't get off the line, but he got off the line just in time so that when it came to the restart, he was able to resume his position from the front. Michael Schumacher didn't do that and had to work his way up from the back. Also had a puncher in that race as well. Nothing bad happened to Irvine. It seemed to happen to everybody else in those top two teams, but not for him. And there's a great moment where, the first safety car period happened when Jacques Villeneuve's rear wing fell off, which is quite hilarious. I'm sure we'll get onto BIR's travails at some point in this. So Irvine followed Hakkinen across the line and then overtook him because Hakkinen was starting to slow. Overtook him because he knew the rules and he couldn't pass before the start-finish straight. But Ralf Schumacher does something very, very canny that you could not do today because Christian Horner will protest you for doing it, which is that he hangs back on the restart. So there's none of this 10 car lengths nonsense.
It wasn't then illegal, to be fair.
No. Yeah, you couldn't do it now. But there was none of this 10 car lengths nonsense. Ralf Schumacher hangs back. And as he sees Irvine just about to cross the line, absolutely guns the throttle and then just bolts past Frentzen as soon as he gets over the start-finish straight. So it's so well judged. Frentzen does get him back a couple of corners later. But it's this interesting interplay because these two drivers had switched teams. So Frentzen had come from Williams, didn't enjoy that atmosphere, one that he didn't really suit him at all. And Ralf Schumacher had gone the other way because the story goes that Michael had paid off part of his contract early to get out of Jordan because of the team orders at Spa 98. So Ralph was now in the Williams and he was effectively the number one driver because Zanardi had such an awful year. But they both had excellent seasons switching places. Frentzen was much more happy, much more at home with Jordan. It had developed a really, really strong car, a development of the 98 car that was started off terribly. Mike Gascoigne had managed to develop it to the point where it was a very, very strong contender. And that Williams, again, as you said, it was a bit middle of the road, but it was very, very sensible. And it was something that he was able to do good things in. And really, that was his breakout year for sure.
Now, one of the things I'm going to come at you with that wasn't so great, and I know you probably won't care about this, but I thought the return of groove tyres and narrow cars, which came in 98, of course, the year before, didn't assist the look of F1 cars particularly well. Now, it depends, obviously, how important you think that. Having said that, I do think a couple of the cars on the grid, the McLaren and the Jordan in 99, were quite good-looking cars. But they added an extra groove, didn't they, for 99 on the front tyre. And I think we've talked to Mick Hakkinen before about saying how edgy even the McLaren was. They handled slightly strange. I remember reading a lot at the time that that was one of the reasons why Zanardi was used to big champ car, big powerful car, big slicks, couldn't really get on top of it. Damon Hill, obviously Frentzen's teammate in the Jordan, didn't have a wonderful season, bearing in mind he actually had quite a good second half of 1998. So do we think maybe from a technical point of view, these weren't, whereas the season itself was fascinating, maybe the cars themselves weren't the best of an F1 breed?
Well, it depends what you want from a Formula One car. I think,
fair.
For me, having grown up with the groove tyres, it didn't look that odd to me. I was super excited when slicks came back in 2009, but for me, it didn't make too much odds because I hadn't experienced Formula One before. And the narrower cars, actually, I think on the whole, the 99 field is actually quite a pretty one. I think the Arrows is a little bit gopping, but
wasn't a fan of the Williams either, if I'm honest.
No, I liked the 99. I didn't like the 98 livery.
Yeah,
the 99 livery was a bit more.
The Stuart
had
wasn't
something a bit more
car
about
either,
it. The Stuart
actually
was a very good looking car. I'll throw the Sauber in as well, actually, and the Prost maybe as well. I think those were, I just like the metallic blue shades, to be honest. But although it did feel sort of anathema to the point of Formula One at that point, these tyres did generate mistakes, as you say, and it was difficult for Zanardi to get on top of it. But I think part of that was also him having to reacquaint himself with something that wasn't steel brakes. And Williams did try steel brakes at that point in the season to get him to feel a little bit more comfortable, but it just didn't work. And, you know, you go slower anyway. I think maybe it was a part of Hill's struggles as well. And again, I'm sure that's something that we can touch on. But again, it did generate mistakes and the cars did look very, very edgy. There's a great YouTube clip of, I think it's Toru Takagi driving around Suzuka in the Arrows, and that car looks like it's about to throw him off the road at any given moment. It looks an absolute handful. But it tested the drivers, and that's kind of what I liked about them.
We're in the V10 era still, of course,
yeah,
as well,
exactly.
So that's a big bonus point.
You've got this unbalanced engine that can swing that rear end out and knock you off at any point at all. I think that's great. I think I love having the driver sort of tested. And that's one of the things that doesn't sit with me about today's F1 quite so much, in that the cars are big, heavy, and they just look so planted all the time. And it's like where you don't see mistakes of that quantity or anymore, I would say.
Just to back up your own argument, well, I was fortunate enough to be at Pembrey for a McLaren sort of track test a couple of years ago, where they had three F1 cars in the last quarter of a century, and the other two cars, I won't say exactly what they were, but they were the V8 era, and everyone, including the engineers, I mean, and Rob Garifol, the driver, were just waiting for the Hakkinen 99 V10 at the end of the day, because it just sounds like it means business. And you walk up to it and it's so much smaller. It doesn't have quite as many of the barge boards and the little aero flicks and whatever, which I know are very kind of technically impressive, but from an aesthetic point of view, it just looks like it's a cool little single seat with a massive V10 in the back and let's go. And it sounded amazing going around Pembrey.
What I like about the, I'm not someone that's ties to noise. Like, I don't mind the turbo hybrids today.
No,
because
I agree
actually
with that.
you can have a conversation at the side of the track. Almost. Obviously, it's still, when you go into the tunnel at Monaco, it's still really loud and you wish you'd brought ear defenders or something. But what I liked about the V10s, particularly of this time, is that you could hear how much throttle the drivers were on. It seemed to have a different cadence at which point you were deploying full throttle to when you were lifting off slightly or that kind of thing. You kind of were almost inside the car with the driver because you could kind of sense just how much power they were deploying at that point.
Well, let's get on to one of my other beefs. I'm challenging you here because we've already had some of these debates already. But for me, and I appreciate that during this series, I haven't actually yet put my opinion forward as the best season, which means I'm just shooting at people, which is a bit unfair, really. But I'd like to see a fight between titans in terms of drivers, which we had in 98 and 2000, I would argue. But Mick Hakkinen versus Eddie Irvine, with all due respect to Eddie Irvine, he did a good job with his one opportunity. Yeah, he, as you say, he was fortunate to win the Australian Grand Prix. I would say the German Grand Prix, obviously Mika Salo, his standing team had to hand to him. The Malaysian Grand Prix was fairly hilarious in that Mark Schumacher came back after being broken for six races, as you say, out-qualified everyone by a second, and then spent most of the race trying to drive slowly enough to let Eddie Irvine win and still had to let him overtake him a couple of times. So that was, I'd say the one win that was probably outstanding was Austria.
And even then, the McLarens came to...
Yeah, but then he did have to hold off DC, didn't he? So I always thought that was a decent win. But really, it was a kind of... Does it not take a little bit of the shine out of it that it wasn't a peak battle between two legends? In the way, we talk about the qualifying session at Suzuka in 2000, when Mark Schumacher and Mick Hakkinen just edging further and further clear of the field as they take thousands off of each other. Absolute, the pinnacle of F1 performance, if you like. 99 feels like it's interesting because nobody was able to do that on a sustained basis.
Well, if I'm being honest, I almost think that the championship battle was a little bit inconsequential.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Because I think the rest of the season was so... I can think of... Okay, so maybe the dullest Grand Prix to ever have happened was in this season, and that takes off some of the shine a little bit, which is Spain 99. But every other race had something interesting going on. And I think it's... Again, almost inconsequential because you just want sort of good races. And then at the end, it was almost like, oh, and Hakkinen's the champion a little bit. I think the way they built their seasons were very, very different. Irvine was actually a lot more consistent.
He was in the points in all but two of the exactly. races. And those are the days where it was point scoring down to the top six, not the top 10.
And that did come to, I think, at the end of the season, his challenge had run out of steam. I think you'd have to say at Monza time, I think that was the point at which it was really starting to kind of grind to a halt a little bit. That race was, he did not have a particularly good race at Monza. And Salo got on the podium that race, which kind of shows you, I think, a little bit about how Irvine had kind of reached the top of his ceiling. I don't think he had much more, I would say, to give. And then Japan was the kind of the final point at which he was almost a lap down on Schumacher by the end of the race. But again, he was consistent. And on the days where you had such chaos, I think, you know, obviously, yes, we spoke about sort of Nürburgring earlier, but France was an incredibly chaotic race and he still got a point out of it at the end when it would have been very, very easy for him not to. Canada was another chaotic race and he finished third. So he has all of that going for him. And how much of it was Irvine actually sort of hitting that ceiling? I think a fair bit of it, but also how much of it was Ferrari being a little bit reluctant to back Irvine because at this point they hadn't won a driver's title for 20 years. Jody Scheckter being the last of that. And they would have loved for it to have been Michael Schumacher. Of course, it couldn't be because he was off for six races. Maybe it could have been shorter. I think the whole reason that he came back was, I don't know if it's an apocryphal story, but Luca de Montezemolo rang his house in Switzerland. His daughter Gina picked up and she said, oh, daddy's just out playing football at the moment. And that was the point at which they realized maybe he's well enough to get back in the car. But I don't think they necessarily wanted to back Irvine because he wasn't the guy. And obviously by the end of the season he was off to Jaguar anyway. Ferrari probably didn't want him taking the number one elsewhere.
Oh, I wonder. That's, I mean, I remember Schumacher getting a little bit of criticism from Ferrari fans at Suzuka for not trying harder to beat Hakkinen, which I thought was a little bit rich given that he was miles ahead of Irvine. So it's like, how much of his job do you want him to do, sort of thing, given that he'd helped him out so much in Malaysia. So I thought that was a bit unfair. Okay, well, before we go back to the looking at the driver ratings, which I think is always quite a fun thing to do, I do think you're right to say there were some fantastic individual races. I guess the ones that immediately come to mind are the French Grand Prix, which obviously had a topsy-turvy grid thanks to, you know, rain-affected qualifying session. And then, of course, the European Grand Prix, the Nürburgring. Have you got a favourite? Which is the one that you're most like? I know you go and watch a lot of these races anyway. Yeah. But which one's the one you watch the most?
I think it is. It's either Nürburgring or it's Australia. I think it's one of those two. I mean, Australia, I can probably tell you everything that happened beat for beat in that race. But Nürburgring was, again, I think it's the highlight of that season.
Yeah, it kind of feels like it, doesn't it? Because all the major players are in there at some point. Well, apart from Mark Schumacher, obviously.
And it's chaos from the start because it's an aborted start and the top five all jump the start. And then we go again. And then there's that clash between... because Damon Hill's car grinds to a halt. Pedro Diniz goes into him, goes upside down and knocks off the entire sort of top half as well.
Yeah, that was quite scary. Yeah,
it was quite scary. And watching him sort of just struggle around in that tiny little gap and eventually managed to get out. Obviously, that wouldn't happen today with the halo and stronger safety equipment, that kind of thing. But it was a little bit scary. But then you have this weather forecast of rain being set to come and Hakkinen jumps on the wet tyres way too early.
He was a little bit weak in the wet, wasn't he?
Yes. And I think maybe him and McLaren kind of jumped on it a little bit soon. I think it was about 7 laps too soon that he was on them, and he was about 7 seconds per lap slower than everybody else. And then you get to the point where Frentzen's car conks out because of what was originally described as an electronics issue. He hadn't been told by Sam Michael to disable the anti-stall systems in the car, which, whether you believe it or not, was used for some kind of traction control-esque workaround.
Possibly, allegedly. Not ever proven.
But has been stated elsewhere. I will put that there on the table. And then you get to a point where Johnny Herbert's gone onto the wet tyres at the right time. Everyone else is falling off the road ahead of him. I think Coulthard comes off the road.
Yeah, Coulthard went off. Ralf Schumacher had a puncture. When he looked Fizzy like he was finally going to get just rewards.
Yeah, Fizzy was in the lead for a bit and then went off.
Or two or three times, I think, because he went off.
I remember watching that race and I was... Because I quite liked the Benetton colour scheme when it was just all light blue. I liked that 99 car. I just thought it was quite cool. And I remember being really disappointed that Fizzy wasn't going to do it. And then Ralf Schumacher fell off the road. And then Johnny Herbert comes around to win. And I was actually like, oh, that's all right, actually. I can take that. And seeing this sort of weird podium of Herbert, Trulli and Barrichello. And I think the only disappointing aspect about that, because Herbert did an excellent job on the day, but given he'd been such a sort of good servant to Stewart and the fact that he'd thrown his lot in with a team that was brand new, it was a big shame that Barrichello didn't get that win, I think. And as we'll get on to, I think he had a fantastic season at Stewart. The car was the best they'd produced, but still very, very unreliable. That was something that kind of had defined Stewart's existence in Formula One, designing very pretty looking cars, sometimes competitive, but often just running out of steam or exploding violently because the Ford had given up, that kind of thing. Otherwise, I think it was a great race.
I can see what you mean about Barrichello, and he did have a stronger season than Herbert for sure. But I was thinking that given the misfortune that dogged Johnny Herbert throughout his F1 career, although his three wins all had the hint of a bit of luck about them, I kind of feel like the universe owed him something. And I spoke to him about that recently, actually, that win, and he did say that he saw the cloud coming in. I think it was down at the hairpin, and he could see it coming directly. He's like, that, when that lands, and he just said, you know, as it was coming up to that pit stop, he was like, he called for wets. And he came in and it was the right call. And of course, I think Barrichello came in a lap or two later and didn't take wets. And that is really what stuffed him. I mean, I think at the time I remember it being a shame that DC went off because that finally finished his championship challenge. And then I felt a bit sorry for Ralph because he'd been so good. He probably deserved a win, Ralph Schumacher, during that season. He just didn't quite get one.
I think the other person we have to feel sorry for in that race is Luca Badoa as well. Running fourth.
Good point.
And then his Minardi. Minardi hadn't scored a point, I don't think, since, gosh, 94, 90, maybe even before that. Hadn't scored a point for years. Badoa was in fourth place. It's running. Everything's looking great. And then his car conks out and he's just...
Australia 95.
95, I was right. He was just absolutely inconsolable at the side of that car. Now, luckily, Marc Genet did get that point at the end of the race. I think he got overtaken by Hakkinen quite late on in that race, but still finished sixth. But that could have been Badoa's big chance, and instead he ends up with a record of, you know, having some of the, I think, most races and not having a point to his name or something along those lines. And then that dogged him when he ended up in the Ferrari 10 years later. So that was a disappointing day for him.
That's a very fair point. Well, let's take a look at some of the driver listings then and the rankings and see here. So in terms of the championship, it was Mick Hakkinen, Eddie Irvine, Heinz Hallfrenz, and David Coulthard, and Michael Schumacher actually beat his brother Ralph to fifth despite missing those six races, plus obviously no score at Silverstone. If you do the averages per race, Michael Schumacher would have won the world championship by a mile in 1999. Now we like to look at the autocourse and autosport rankings. So the autocourse rankings decided to exclude Marc Schumacher because he'd missed those races, which is an interesting position to take, but it does make the list a little bit easier. So at five, your mate Rubens Barrichello; four, Eddie Irvine; three, Ralph Schumacher; two, Mick Hakkinen, who actually won the championship; and one, Heinz Hallfrenzen. The autosport top 10, which was done by Martin Brundle that year, was Eddie Irvine in five, Frentzen four, so a big difference there; three, Ralph Schumacher; two, Marc Schumacher. Martin decided to keep Schumacher in, which I think, given that he did 2/3 of the season, let's say,
yeah,
was probably fair enough. And Mick Hakkinen in number one as the champion. So very different lists there, really. Where do you sit? Who would be your standout driver of 99? And do you think that Marc Schumacher should be in the list?
I think on the balance he should be, but I think I would put him a little bit lower for that reason, I think.
Sort of penalise him for not being there, sort of
a little
thing.
Bit. I think he still is worthy of inclusion, but I think when you look at the seasons of Frentzen and Ralph Schumacher, and again probably Barrichello actually, because when the Stewart wasn't breaking down, you know, he could have won in Brazil, for example, and probably should have done. And there were several other instances where he was running in the points and the car just conked out. I think they all sort of kept a better account of themselves, and I think I don't know if Martin would remember doing it because it's, you know, given it's 26 years on, but I think Hakkinen first is a little bit optimistic, again, given...
Well, in terms of raw pace, there's no doubt about it, is there?
Raw pace doth butter no parsnips sometimes when it comes to keeping it on the road.
That phrase has not appeared in this series so far, and I suspect it won't do again.
Where was I? And then looking at the other rankings as well, Johnny Herbert being in both, so 8th for auto course and 10th for autosport. It's kind of much for muchness, because then you've got him, Fisichella and Villeneuve all together, just sort of on Villeneuve. He had that horrific run, I think, of 11 retirements in a row. Most of them due to the BAR being incredibly unreliable. Now, I liked that car. I thought that the zip livery, it's incredibly stupid, but I quite like that.
And well, it's because they weren't allowed to run two different liveries, wasn't it, within the same team?
They wanted to run Villeneuve in sort of white and red half over the whole car, and Ricardo Zonta, who was coming in to Formula One for the first time, well, as a driver for the first time, in the blue car. But... And Adrian Reynard was very, very optimistic. I think, I understand this is apocryphal because I think it wasn't quite worded the same way, but everyone said, oh, they think they're going to win their first race and that kind of thing. But of course, that didn't happen. It was just simply because when it came to running that super tech engine, it had vibrations that the team hadn't anticipated. And so when it came to designing suspension packages or designing other things, it was running at a frequency that would shatter bits to, well, bits to pieces. And so you had this very, very long, lengthy retirement spell for Jacques Villeneuve. He qualified very, very high up a lot of the time. Ended up third by the end of the first lap at Spain, for example. He was doing a fantastic job with that car, putting it in places that it probably shouldn't have been. But the thing is, it always ended up at the side of the road or in the pit lane.
Yeah, they ended up 11th in the Constructors' Championship behind even Minardi, because Minardi got that point that you've already mentioned at the Nürburgring. I suppose there are some historical things we should pick out. Ferrari's first Constructors' Championship since 1983, beat McLaren by 4 points, which says a lot, given what Ferrari went through with replacement drivers and Schumacher not being there. It gives you some idea of the turmoil at McLaren, I would say. Jordan, highest ever finished. And obviously, ultimately, they're now, I suppose, the Aston Martin team.
Yes. After a long and series
of a podcast in its own right. As you say, the Stewart team, that was their last year before becoming Jaguar, and obviously that they became Red Bull. So there are a few little historical moments in there. And Barr, of course, BAR, which then became Honda, which then became Braun, which now becomes Mercedes.
Yes. Long lineage of teams.
Yes, and I think they bought the Tyrrell. There's the link to Tyrrell, isn't it? I know it was new, and you can't add the stats together, but there's a link back to the original
Tyrrell
team.
It owns the asset, or owns the rights to the company that Tyrrell was run under. So they changed that with Companies House, but I believe it's still the same registration number or something like that, as I understand
it. Yes, that's right. That was it. Yeah, well remembered. So you haven't actually said who you're going to put as your number one driver then?
That is a good question.
If not Hakkinen?
I think on balance, I would have to say Frentzen. And again, it was just simply because the progress that he'd shown over 1999. I probably am biased because I would have loved to have seen him win that title.
That would have been amazing,
Unfortunately, everything after Nürburgring and onwards, that was kind of the end of that challenge. But I think the progress that he and Jordan had shown over the off-season was tremendous. And him going into that team and immediately from the off, finding it a much more pleasant atmosphere, it just showed kind of what people had thought about him. As this, when Williams had signed him, for example, it was under the premise that he was this Schumacher beater, and if they can't get Michael Schumacher, then he's the next best thing. And unfortunately, it doesn't work out because his demeanour, let's say, was completely at odds with the sort of Frank and Patrick school.
He needed an arm round the shoulder.
Yeah,
him,
exactly.
They
liked drivers like Alan Jones and Juan Pablo Montoya, and Frentzen was not like either of those. And the way his season went as well, that was the point at which, Damon Hill's retirement was accelerated. And I'll go off on a little bit of a tangent here, because I think it's worth talking about Hill when we're talking about Frentzen, we're talking about Jordan. Actually, when you look at his qualifying results, Hill was not far off Frentzen. I think I've pulled up the stats here. So over the whole season, Hill's average qualifying was 9.75, Frentzen was 5.31, which it's a big gap, but it's not Hill's qualifying in the lower half of the field every weekend. There was a period between Monaco and I think France where his form dipped significantly, and that was because he'd qualified well for Melbourne but then got taken out by Trulli. He was having lots of issues. Maybe there was a couple of instances where he'd thrown off the road himself. But Hill genuinely did nearly quit after the French Grand Prix. That was the point at which he was going to give it up. And I think Jordan was glad he didn't, because it might not have done quite so well in the championship had it happened, because they'd scheduled a test for Silverstone the week after the French Grand Prix. Hill was going to quit. He'd parked the car up, walked out. They'd put Jos Verstappen in for the test and Shinji Nakano, both drivers affiliated with Honda at the time. Verstappen doing the Honda test car that never happened because of their, well, their entry was canned. And Nakano was a long time Honda affiliate driven for Prost because Honda had made them take him. They did 2 days each. Verstappen's best time was a 1:28.3. Nakano's best time was a 1:28.5. So about a quarter of a second difference between them. Hill did the final 2 days and he was 1.5 seconds quicker than either of them.
It's a big gap, isn't it?
So putting him, him staying in that car, Jordan wouldn't have, I don't think would have lost any positions per se, but Hill then finished fifth or Silverstone and did generally quite an admirable job over the rest of the season in qualifying. I think in the races, that was, his focus was not quite there anymore. I think
he did score a couple more points in Hungary and Belgium, but that's an interesting, good little test story, that.
Yeah, I think so. I think to sort of bring it back to the topic of who was the best driver, I think you'd have to give it to Frentzen just because of the way that, again, in what was the third best car, he dragged it into a title race that he probably shouldn't have been in, and, you know, made a world champion severely think about his future prospects at the team.
Yeah, I think I'm tempted to say Frentzen 1, Ralf Schumacher 2, Hakkinen 3, Mark Schumacher 4. Given what he achieved when he was around, and then I don't know, maybe I'd toss a coin between, you can't do, I was going to say three drivers, you can't toss a coin over three drivers, and where is it, but Eddie Irvine,
depends,
and
Jacques
Villeneuve or Rubens Barrichello probably, and of course this was the year before Barrichello went to Ferrari, so yeah. he was the coming man at this point.
Well, I'll put a hypothetical to you, when it comes to the chap, had Irvine and Barrichello done their swap a year early, let's say, do you think Barrichello would have won that title?
Yeah, probably.
I agree.
I think so, yeah. Yeah, because I think the difference between Irvine and Barrichello was mental strength, wasn't it, as they showed when they were teammates at Jordan. But I think in terms of I mean, would Rubens have made more mistakes than Irvine? That's the only thing. I think he would have been quicker, but would he have made more errors? Because Irvine was pretty solid, wasn't he, to be fair?
I think given the situation, because the situation that irked Barrichello the most was the fact that he wasn't given parity with Schumacher. You give him an opportunity where Schumacher's not in the picture and he's the guy that you rally around. I think that's a situation where he thrives, to be honest.
Yeah, it's interesting. So could Rubens Barrichello have been the 1999 world champion?
I don't think he would have finished sixth at Imola, miles away from Mika
Salo. No, you're probably right. But then it seems correct to me that Mika Hakkinen is a double world champion.
Yes,
I think
I agree
so.
With that.
I kind of, in overall history terms, I think it sort of works. But it is an interesting one. Well, before we tie things up, is there any final statement you want to make advocating 99?
Advocating.
So you've done a good job, to be fair.
I think, honestly, things are available on the internet, and it's a season that I think people should just, you know, go back and watch, even if it's just out of curiosity, if you've not seen it before. Australia is obviously a fantastic place to start because it's the season opener. It kind of, it sets the tone for the season. I think the least interesting part about that race is that Giancarlo Fisichella finishes fourth.
And yet you picked it out.
Yeah, because everything around that is completely and utterly bizarre. Now, you do have the complete converse race at the Spanish Grand Prix, but everything else is, it has something interesting, it offers something new, and it's a genuinely interesting season of lots of individual races that eventually all kind of tie together and smash together for some kind of championship standings. So I would say as a cohesive season, maybe it's not a great one, but as a
collection of individual races,
a collection of races, I think it's definitely one of the best.
Now, can we also credit 99 with the Champions Wall Montreal thing?
Yes.
Or because, I mean, that's famously when, I mean, Mark Schumacher obviously crashed in there. I think Damon went in there as well. They weren't the first because Villeneuve had crashed there previously. But is it 99 that the Champions Wall really comes about?
It was 99, I think, that it first entered the lexicon, as it were, because you had Schumacher, Hill and Villeneuve all go into that wall during the race. And if you want to sort of add tangentially to that, Ricardo Zonta did as well. And he was the FIA GT, reigning FIA GT champion at the time, and the 97 Formula 3000 champion.
I mean,
champion.
That's obviously what got it over the line.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, it was champions of all categories, I think. I think that was fair to say. And I think if you watch the Canadian, as we're recording this, the Canadian Grand Prix was last weekend. Oscar Piastri hit it in qualifying. I don't know if that's a harbinger of things to come. And Nico Hülkenberg didn't, because technically he wasn't a GP2 champion. He was a series winner in their PR speak.
No. Well, I think
Hülkenberg nearly went into it, and he's definitely not a Formula One champion anyway.
Yes, well, before we completely disappear down yet another tangent, we should probably tie it up there. So thank you very much, Jake Rosselegg. 1999 is his season. What do you think? Let us know. Is 1999 up there in the top F1 seasons? It's made it into this series. Let us know at allsport@allsport.com, or drop me an email at kevin.turn@allsport.com. We'll be back soon with another All Sport podcast.